brothers and sisters, to continue from last time, we try to establish, looking at the background of the life of the Lord, that it was no accident that the Lord appeared on the scene when he did. It had already been prearranged, predetermined, prophesied of, as far as the Old Testament scriptures were concerned. And we saw it in basically two ways, that the iniquity as far as the Jews were concerned had come to a full. And secondly, from a secular point of view, from a state point of view, God had predetermined that it was necessary that the Roman Empire had taken over from the Greeks to order to give us the circumstances and the environment in which the Lord was to find himself. And we got to the point at the end of last class to Daniel chapter 11. Because what we wanted to try and establish, what is seemingly a gap between the Old and the New Testament, that's 400 or so years, which we have from the end of Malachi to the beginning of Matthew chapter 1, was being used by God not for direct prophesying, because there was no prophet to be heard or seen at that time. But nevertheless, the prophecies which had already been given were being worked out. And that period between the testaments was very important as far as the circumstances in which the Lord was to find himself during his ministry. And what we said we would commence tonight doing was to look at Daniel chapter 11, basically from verse 30 to 35. Now, I passed some notes round for those of you who haven't looked at Daniel chapter 11 in detail before, and by no means are they exhaustive, but they do give some indication as to what the fulfillment of the verses in Daniel chapter 11 are all about. As we saw, they principally concerned the battles which existed between the Ptolemies of Egypt, surnamed the King of the South, and the Seleucids of Syria, spoken of as the King of the North. And we saw that these two powers were the part of the subdivision of the Grecian Empire after that Alexander had met his death at the age of 33. And we saw at the end of last class that the reason that Daniel chapter 11 deals in such detail with the wars between the King of the North and the King of the South is because they affected the land of Israel. And it was because of their effect upon the land and upon the people that Daniel had this prophecy recorded to him. Now, we don't propose to go through all the verses, as we have said. We want to concentrate on verses 30 to 35. Because those are very important as far as understanding the circumstances in which the Lord was to find himself. Now, the notes will give you some of the background, so we'll just pick up the thought in verse 30. For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and returned, and have indignation against the holy covenant, so shall he do. He shall even return, have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. Now the person being spoken of in verse 30 as the him is Antiochus Epiphanes. And he was one of the rulers of the northern power which had gone down into Egypt, and at this point in time the northern kingdom, the king of the north, was overpowering and overcoming the king of the south. And it was whilst he was down in Egypt that the ships of Chittim came against him. And if you look at your notes, you will see that the explanation of this is that a Greek fleet with Roman ambassadors on board arrived while he, that's this Antiochus Epiphanes, was in full tide of conquest, and in the name of the Roman Senate demanded evacuation of Egypt. Reluctantly, Antiochus had to concede to this request. But on his way back to Syria, he vented his rage upon Jerusalem, and he entered into alliance with the unfaithful among the Jews, And he detached 20,000 men under a general called Apollinus with orders basically to destroy the city of Jerusalem. And that's why in verse 30, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. And his determination was to destroy the city of Jerusalem. He shall even return and have, notice, intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. And profane history records that these were the unfaithful Jews who were more than willing to be in allegiance with the king of the north in order that they might be on the winning side, even if that meant destroying their own city. And so in verse 31, and Arm shall stand on his part, and notice, they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And so this army of 20,000 men was dispatched by Antiochus to destroy a great part of the city. He profaned the temple, he suppressed the daily sacrifice, and he placed a Greek idol on the altar. He also commanded the Jews to eat swine's flesh, and he did many abominable things in suppressing virtually all the audiences of the Jews. He was typical of the people of that time, very anti-Semitic. But you'll notice at the end of verse 31, they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Now I'm sure you appreciate the words of the Master in Matthew chapter 24. It's worth having a look at the Lord's comment upon this in Matthew chapter 24. Because he is using the circumstances which appeared in the days of Antioch Epiphanes as a type of what was going to happen to the Jews yet again. We read from verse 11 of Matthew 24. Many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth let him understand, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that could suck in those days. And we all appreciate what the Lord Jesus Christ is speaking of. He is speaking in answering the question of the Apostle Peter, when he said, when shall these things be? When the temple would be taken down brick by brick. When one stone should not be left upon another. And the Master was prophesying concerning what happened in AD 70. And he said, in the midst of his answer to the question, when shall these things be? In verse 15, as we have noticed, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. So why does the Master make that comment? Whoso readeth, let him understand. I believe, brothers and sisters, for two important reasons. First of all, to extract what he means from Daniel chapter 11 is no easy matter. It is not straightforward to be able to go back to Daniel chapter 11 and understand what the Master meant by the abomination of desolation. what the Master was emphasizing, brethren and sisters, that history would never be easy to understand or appreciate. It's not as exciting as exposition. It's not as rewarding as exhortation. But the Master is saying it's vital. Because unless we appreciate and understand the historical significance of Daniel chapter 11, no way shall we appreciate what was going to happen to the Jews in AD 70. And secondly, the reason I believe he puts the phrase in there is that it's not an exact quotation. He is not saying that Daniel chapter 11 and verse 31 is the fulfillment of what he is saying. What he is emphasizing is that what happened back in Daniel 11 verse 31 is what's going to happen, i.e. it's a type of what was to be seen in AD 70. And so what do we see with the desire of Antiochus Epiphanes to destroy the city of Jerusalem, to take away the law, the holy place, the sacrifices, and all the ordinances of the Jews? And that was Antiochus' intention. And to do that, he placed a strong amount of men, 20,000 of his army, there in the city of Jerusalem. And he established a garrison fort. And his idea was to completely and utterly destroy that city. Now, think again of Matthew 24 and verse 15. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place. Can we go back to Daniel chapter 9? And in the prophecy concerning Messiah the Prince, which we have come to know as the 70 weeks prophecy, we find in verse 27 at the end of that prophecy that we read, "He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate." And there the Master is linking the thought of Daniel 11 verse 31 with the one here in verse 27. That at the end of the prophecy concerning Messiah the Prince, there would be this overspreading of abominations to make desolate. And that couldn't have been Antiochus. We're now at the time at the end of the prophecy concerning Messiah the Prince. And therefore, as Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 8, and Daniel chapter 11 has confirmed, it's the power that would be in the earth at the time of Messiah the Prince, the Roman power, the fourth great power of Daniel 7. It would be he who would be the abomination that maketh desolate, in order to fulfill exactly which had been seen before in the time of Antiochus, to destroy the city and to desecrate the holy place. And therefore, brothers and sisters, when the Master says, "Whoso readeth, let him understand," I believe we ought to stop and take note to those words. We must appreciate that the thing that hath been is that which shall be. There is no new thing under the sun. So although I be the first to acknowledge and agree, Daniel chapter 11 is an awful lot of history, which, as I said, doesn't thrill us, as some of the expositions we shall look at do. But unless we get the backgrounds of these things correct, unless we put the foundation down, we will never be able to build on the words of what the Lord says. So it's he who takes us back to this Daniel chapter 11. And therefore, brothers and sisters, it was Antiochus's intention to destroy God's people. And in verse 32, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries." But notice, "But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." He will try and corrupt everything, but the people that know their God shall be strong. Now you'll notice the contrast between that and verse 30. In verse 30, we have those who had forsaken the Holy Covenant, the unfaithful Jews. But now we have some people who know their God. And notice in verse 33, "And they that understand among the people shall instruct many." And these are those who have become known in history as the Maccabees. The "they" in verse 33 are Mattathias and his five sons, the family of the Maccabees. These, as the notes say, were the only party among the people possessed of scriptural understanding, and they exerted themselves to the instruction of as many as would listen, and got up a powerful movement in the defense of the law. But for 7 years, the tide of events was adverse to them, and they were scattered and oppressed by war. Now again, just put it into the context of Daniel chapter 11. We've got one of the most powerful sections of the Grecian army, the Seleucids of Syria. And the Seleucids had determined to destroy God's people and the city of Jerusalem, possibly out of pique, because they had to go back from Egypt. But in verse 33, "They that understand shall instruct many," and therefore there was this powerful movement which arose in the land to oppose the activities of Antiochus. It just proves, brothers and sisters, what influence the word of God amongst faithful people can have in the outworking of God's purpose. No doubt if these Maccabees families hadn't influenced others, then the resistance of the Jews would probably have been nil, and they would have been overridden totally by the king of the north. But at that time, it was not in God's purpose. And as so often has happened in history, he has raised up a man or a family or a woman, as the case may be, in order to perform the requirements of his will. And at this point in time, it was the Maccabees who influenced many others to resist the power of the north. And on an exhortational note, brothers and sisters, we too can have an influence for good, both ecclesially and in this world in which we live. All things are for your sakes. All things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. And we never want to underestimate that the word in season can have a remarkable effect in things which are happening. It might just be a word which pricks the conscience of somebody, which will further God's purpose. And here it was the Maccabees who didn't just rise up themselves, but tried to influence others to show them that what they were doing was right, was on the side of God, and therefore if God was for them, who could be against them? And so although they suffered many setbacks, nevertheless, we find that there was this resistance movement amongst the people. And so in verse 34, "Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries." And notice, as we've put in the notes, at the end of the 7 years, the tide turned. Judas Maccabees, one of the family that had made themselves conspicuous in opposition to Antiochus, raised an army and defeated the enemy's forces in several encounters. Many unfaithful Jews joined the Maccabean party when they saw it was succeeding. And of course that's quite common, is it not? Everyone always wants to seem to be on the winning side. And I'm sure we've all read the incidents of the Six-Day War back in June 1967, when just a few Jews scattered so many of their enemy. But you just listen to this as far as Judas Maccabees was concerned. With 3,000 men only, he defeated in one battle 47,000 of the opposing enemy. In another battle, another 20,000. And in the year BC 170, he dispersed 65,000 of the enemy. What do you reckon, brothers and sisters, is meant by the phrase in verse 34, "He shall be holpen with a little help"? It was certainly against all odds. From a military point of view, it would have been impossible for Judas Maccabees to have routed so many. On the same basis, we would say that it would have been impossible from a military point of view for the Jews in the Six-Day War to have routed so many. But with God on their side, nothing was impossible. And therefore I would suggest that the holpen with a little help there is the help they received from the Almighty. Obviously it was still through much tribulation they were to succeed, but nevertheless, in the purpose of God, it was necessary that this resistance built up amongst the Jews at that time, even turning many who had opposed these things to them, and they shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding, in verse 35, shall fall, to try them and to purge, and to make them white even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And we've made the note there, at the time of the Jewish independence, adversity again befell the nation, that the faithful might be tried and made ready for the work of the time of the end, when many that sleep in the dust shall awake, which was an appointed a long way off, as Daniel intimates in the beginning of the vision. So during this time, for those who would be faithful to God and to his word, it was a time of trying and testing to see whether indeed they would be purged to be white until the time of the end. So verses 30 to verse 35 is the interlude, as it were, in these wars between the king of the south and the king of the north, to demonstrate the uprise of this resistance amongst the Jews as far as the Maccabean family was concerned and others. Now these things are very important. Although I acknowledge that they might not appear to be on first reading, I believe they are very important, brothers and sisters, again for two reasons. The first one, I believe, is in Ezekiel chapter 4. Because in Ezekiel chapter 4, we have a prophecy there which I'm sure we all appreciate because of the circumstances in which it was given and what Ezekiel, that man of sign, had to do. And if we read from verse 1 to verse 8 of Ezekiel 4, we'll get the understanding, I believe, of this prophecy. "Thou also, son of man, take thee a tile and lay it before thee, and portray upon it the city, even Jerusalem. And lay siege against it, and build a fort against it, and cast a mount against it, set the camp also against it, and set battering rams against it round about. Moreover, take thou unto thee an iron pan, and set it for a wall of iron between thee and the city, and set thy face against it, and it shall be besieged, and thou shalt lay siege against it, this shall be a sign to the house of Israel. Lie thou also upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it, according to the number of the days that thou shalt bear, lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. And when thou hast accomplished them, lie again on thy right side, and thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days, for I have appointed thee each day for a year. Therefore thou shalt set thy face toward the siege of Jerusalem, and thine arm shall be uncovered, and thou shalt prophesy against it. And behold, I will lay bands upon thee, and thou shalt not turn thee from one side to another, till thou hast ended the days of thy siege. And so Ezekiel was to enact this prophecy concerning the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And in total we have got 430 days, and on the basis of verse 6, each day for a year, God had determined 430 years against his people. Now, we must put Ezekiel into context. He was with the captives which were by the river Kiba. He'd been taken away in the second captivity of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And the significance about that, as far as the prophecy was concerned, is that the kingdom, the nation of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, denoted as Ephraim, had been taken into captivity by Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, many, many years before. So when Ezekiel received this prophecy, Israel was no nation. There was no nation as far as the 10 northern tribes were concerned. You remember when the king of Assyria took Israel captive, he transported back to the land part of his own people, and they became known as the Samaritans because they intermingled and intermarried with the poor and the maimed which had been left in the land. And therefore, from a prophetic point of view, the 10 tribes never returned out of captivity. And therefore, we still speak prophetically that the Jews are in the dispersion today are the 10 northern tribes of Ephraim. Not because they can link themselves back to those 10 tribes, but it will be Judah who will be in the land at the Lord's return, where Israel are still in the dispersion, and it will be the work of the Elijah who gathers them back to the land, so the two become one in the hand of Messiah. So when Ezekiel received the prophecy, the nation of Israel was no more. And yet, in verse 5, he was told to lay upon himself the years of the iniquity of the children of Israel, 390 years. And then it was going to be 40 years for the house of Judah. Now there have been many different interpretations, brothers and sisters, of Ezekiel chapter 4. I can't see how they can be separated as far as the prophecy was concerned. What I believe the Almighty was doing was putting the iniquity of both Israel and Judah upon Ezekiel as a man of sign to demonstrate that for 430 days, 430 years, God's wrath would be against his people. Now, for those who like to read historical events, if I can commend to you Elpis Israel on this matter, and I'll give you the page for those who want to read it. Page 404, Brother Thomas gives a very interesting treatise concerning Ezekiel chapter 4. But that by the by. Now if we date this prophecy of Ezekiel chapter 4 from the fall of Jerusalem, we would have the year BC 586. Some authorities will differ a year either way. But approximately BC 586 was the siege upon Jerusalem. Now if we take 430 years from then, that's 390 and 40, we come to BC 156. And BC 156 brings us to the time of Daniel chapter 11 and verse 35. When the resistance of the Maccabees had caused Jerusalem to be freed from its oppressor. When the Jews had a say in what went on in the land. And therefore, brothers and sisters, it could well be. And it's up for you to be determined in your own mind whether that is what Ezekiel chapter 4 is all about. There is no question in mind that it is. And therefore, if it is, we come in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 35 to the fulfillment of the prophecy of Ezekiel. That there would be, at now, this period in time, a respite for the Jews. And therefore, brothers and sisters, it could well be, and it's up for you to be determined in your own mind whether that is what Ezekiel chapter 4 is all about. There is no question in mind that it is. And therefore, if it is, we come in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 35 to the fulfillment of the prophecy of Ezekiel. That there would be, at now, this period in time, a respite for the Jews, and that they once again could exert some influence in the land. So perhaps that's one of the reasons why we should consider the circumstances of Daniel chapter 11 from verse 30 to verse 35. But perhaps from our study point of view, brothers and sisters, there is a more important reason. Because during the Maccabean periods, the two great parties which we have come to know as the Pharisees and the Sadducees came into existence. It was during the time from verse 32 to verse 35, during this period of the Maccabees, that the Pharisees and the Sadducees came into existence. Now again, brothers and sisters, I cannot believe that this was accidental. That providence obviously overruled the circumstances of the time to give this respite as far as the Jews were concerned with the upsurgence of the Maccabean family in order for these religious sects to come into being, because as we saw last time, it was necessary for the iniquity of the Jews to come to the full. And these two sects, among above any other, so corrupted the truth as it was in the things which the Jews had espoused with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, that the iniquity that we find in the gospel records had indeed come to the full. And the circumstances during the uprise of the Maccabean family gave the impetus to these sects to develop. Now, if we can go to Acts of the Apostles in chapter 23, when Paul perceived that one part was Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and of the hope and resurrection of the dead I am called in question." And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude were divided. I am called in question. And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude were divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. So one of the main differences between the Sadducees and the Pharisees is that the Sadducees deny a resurrection. Now that is important to appreciate, brothers and sisters, because Paul here was arraigned before the high priest, verse 2. And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. And Ananias was a Sadducee. Caiaphas was a Sadducee. Annas was a Sadducee. The high priesthood was following the sects of the Sadducees. So why is that important? Because it was the high priest who wanted Jesus to be put to death. Come to John chapter 11. It's after the raising from the dead of Lazarus. The Sadducees deny that there is such a thing as resurrection. And in verse 49, one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest the same year, said unto them, "You know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not." And this he spake, not of himself, but being the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. Now obviously, the words came out of the mouth of Caiaphas as they had come out of the mouth of Balaam. There was no credit to him in what was being said here, because, as verse 51 says, he spake not of himself. But nevertheless, it was in Caiaphas' purpose that the master should be killed. Because if master could be killed, as far as Caiaphas was concerned, that would be the end, because he denied such a thing as resurrection. So if the master could be put to death, nothing more could be heard or seen of him. And therefore it was important, as far as these circumstances were concerned, to appreciate that the high priesthood and the priests mainly were of the order and the sect of the Sadducees. We'll always remember the difference, because you've all heard that awful joke that the reason they were sad is because they denied the resurrection. And the apostle says, if we deny the resurrection, we're of all men most miserable. That's why they were sad, you see. And you will always know the difference between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, because they denied the resurrection. And because of that, they were all men most miserable. But let's just look at the history of the Pharisees and the Sadducees as they came into existence during the Maccabean period. The word Pharisee means a separated one. It literally means separated. And the Pharisees' main characteristic was a complete and utter observance of the law of Moses, both oral and written. Their watchwords were repentance, prayer, and charitable giving. The thing to appreciate also about the Pharisees is that they were always a minority group. At the time of the Master, it is estimated that they numbered only about 6,000. There was only in total about 6,000 Pharisees. The main attraction of the Pharisees for the people was that most of the Pharisees came from the lower or middle of society, and therefore they had a better understanding of the common man, and they genuinely tried to make the law more tolerable for that class of men. I suppose if we put it in modern parlance, the Pharisees would be socialists. They would be followers of Mr. Kinnock and his band of men. They came from the so-called working class, and they had socialist principles, apart, of course, they applied things very much on a religious level. Now, although the Pharisees believed in a resurrection, they didn't believe in the resurrection as we understand it. They believed in the immortality of the soul. And therefore, when the Pharisees thought of resurrection, they thought as the churches would, that when you die, some part of you, obviously, ascends to a place of bliss. And therefore, they believed in the immortality of the soul. They went a bit further. They believed that the soul would become a reincarnated body. And therefore, in this resurrection body, it would reign somewhere and somehow. And so they believed in reincarnation, linked to their thoughts of the immortal soul. And we shall come to appreciate the import of that when we look at the rich man and Lazarus. They also believed that fate was overruled by God. They had a great belief in what their lives were ordered and directed by God. Now, obviously, with the Pharisees, they added to the law what became known as the traditions of men. And it's interesting that one of the earlier tasks of the Pharisees was to establish the contents of the written law. And they determined, how we don't know, that the law contained 613 commandments. Perhaps some of you would like to establish whether that's true one day. They reckoned that the law of Moses contained 613 commandments, 248 positive ones, and 365 negative ones. And they took this law and decided to interpret and supplement it by adding their own thinking and their own thoughts upon it. And it became known, obviously, as the Master says, the tradition of the elders. And perhaps if you look at Mark's Gospel and chapter 7, the Master makes reference to this. Verse 2, and when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, with unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands, oft eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. And this tradition of the elders was the extra comments, this enlargement of the law, the explanation which the Pharisees had put on the 613 commandments to enable the working class of the people, the common people, the lower and the middle class, to interpret the law. Again, I suppose we could say they became the verse-by-verse notes of the day. They were there to help the people. But the sad part was that they claimed that these extra thoughts, these enlargements, these explanations of the law were direct from Moses. And therefore they claimed it not just as a note, as an explanation, but as divine authority. And they put as much credence in the tradition of the elders as they did in the law itself. So it wasn't a question that you could either accept or reject the suggested exposition of the law. It was sacrosanct. It had to be accepted at all cost. And therefore, brethren and sisters, it became part of the law as far as the Pharisees were concerned. Now that again helps us to appreciate the comments which we receive in the New Testament concerning their appreciation of certain things which were not written in the law of Moses, but had become law as far as the people of the Jews were concerned at the time of the law, of the Lord. And therefore these Pharisees were responsible, because they thought that they were custodians of the law, that they could add to what God had written. Now, contrast, the Sadducees were a totally different sort of people. It's suggested that they probably originated from Zadok. You remember, one of Solomon's priests. But they didn't come to any prominence until the time of the Maccabees. Now, the name Sadducees means righteous. And that's why people or authorities suggest it probably came from Zadok, which means exactly the same. The Sadducees had their following amongst the well-to-do. It was from the aristocrats of the day that the Sadducees took their support. And therefore, again, I suppose, if we brought it up to date, they would be the conservative party of today, although again, they were religiously biased and not just political. Now, the important thing to remember about the Sadducees is that many, but not all priests, were Sadducees. But it was a fact that nearly all the Sadducees appear to be priests. Not all priests were Sadducees, but it seems that virtually all Sadducees were priests. And therefore, they commanded the hierarchy as far as the priesthood were concerned. In religion, the Sadducees are marked for their conservatism. They believed in living for the day, and therefore they deny really any afterlife. Under the Herods, the Sadducees dominated the Sanhedrin. And both Caiaphas and Annas was a Sadducee. And therefore the religious power at the time of the Lord was in the hands of these Sadducees, who deny the things which we looked at in Acts chapter 23. Now again, brothers and sisters, these powers came into being during the time of the Maccabees. And we're going to trace, as we go on, the way that these powers, these sects, the Pharisees and Sadducees, influenced the people at the time of our Lord. But before we do that, I'd like to pass another document round, because there's something I want to link in with this. So if you've all got the charts now, you've got two sides. One is a map which gives us Palestine under Herod the Great and Palestine during Jesus' ministry. And on the reverse, the history of the Herods, or the outline of the Herods of the New Testament. And as one writer says, we shall never understand the four Gospels unless we get to grips with who was the Herods of the time. Because the main one, who appeared only early on in the Gospels, was Herod the Great. And it was from him which came the various sons, which was to have an influence, not only upon the life of our Lord, but very much upon the people of that time. Now, if you look back at your map, you'll notice that there is a difference between Palestine under Herod the Great, who reigned from BC 40 to BC 4, and during the time of the Lord's ministry when it is split up into various regions. Now, if you go to Luke chapter 3 and in verse 1, it's the Gospel writer Luke who gives us some details concerning the split up of the territory. Now we read in verse 1, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip tetrarch of Iturea, and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias the tetrarch of Abilene. Now if you look at your map, you will see most of these placed upon the map. We have got Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea. So with a very dark, thick black line, we've got Samaria in the north and Judea in the south being ruled over by Pontius Pilate. This was not under the direct control of the Herods. He was governor of Judea and Samaria, appointed directly by Rome. Now we shall see the reasons for that a bit later on. But whilst we're still looking at the map, we then have two areas which are under the jurisdiction of the one called here Herod, being tetrarch of Galilee. And this Herod is Herod Antipas. Now if you look back to your chart of the Herods, he was one of the sons of Herod the Great, and he became famous or infamous because he was the one who married Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, and of course was responsible for the murder of John the Baptist. And therefore this Herod Antipas was the tetrarch of Galilee and Perea. And if you notice, you've got a little dotted line, or a thick dotted line, around the region of Galilee and Perea, which was the tetrarch of Herod Antipas. And if you've ever wondered what the word tetrarch means, it simply denotes one of four rulers, or governing a fourth part of a region. Because after the death of Herod the Great, the territory was split into four parts. And a tetrarch is somebody who rules over one of those four parts. And the tetrarch of Herod Antipas was Galilee and Perea. Then we've got a dotted line around what became known as Iturea and Trachonitis. You'll notice on the map Trachonitis is mentioned. What isn't mentioned is Iturea, but Iturea was simply the northernmost part of that region. So all the dotted area, or all the area within the dotted area, was ruled over by another person, and that one is spoken of in verse 1 as Philip, the tetrarch of Iturea. Now again, if you come back to your chart of the Herods, he was another of the sons of the Herods, because the Herods was the family name. It wasn't sort of the name of a king or the name of the ruler, it was the family name, as Johnson would be. But we are distinguished by the Christian name, as we call it, and therefore you know me different from my son because of the Christian names. So Herod was the family name. It was Herod Antipas who had ruled over Galilee and Perea, and Herod Philip, or Philip Herod, who ruled over Trachonitis and Iturea. We then have another area, and the other area at the end of chapter, at the end of verse 1 of chapter 3, is Lysanias, the tetrarch of Abilene. And Abilene is north of the dotted line. So the whole of Abilene is beyond the dotted line. And that was ruled over by this man, Lysanias. And Lysanias descended directly from the Greeks. He was nothing to do at all with the Herod kings. He was a Greek, or a descendant of the Greek. And the only contact we have with Lysanias is the mention here in chapter 3 in verse 1. He was nothing to do with the Herods. We then have a part in the middle
which is Decapolis. Now, we read of Decapolis back in the Gospel of Matthew. Can we just go back to Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4 and verse 25. There followed him great multitudes of people from Galilee and from Decapolis and from Jerusalem and from Judea and from beyond Jordan. And that's the Decapolis, which is with a thinner black line all the way round. We come to know it more in the Gospels because it contained the place, as you'll notice, of Gadara. And it was the Gadarenes where the swine were feeding, which caused obviously the miracle to take place, which we know. Now, there is no place I've been able to look, and I've looked in literally scores of books, there's no authority who will give us who was the ruler of Decapolis. It's not mentioned scripturally, and it doesn't seem to be mentioned in profane history either. It's quite an important area. The one thing we can obviously deduce is that it must have been quite Gentile dominated, because you wouldn't have swine feeding if there were Jewish population there. It was obviously forbidden by the law. And therefore it does seem to be of a Gentile origin. But who was reigning over it at that time, we don't know. What we do know, it was part of Herod the Great's kingdom. And it was one of the four parts in which his empire, if we like, was broken up into. But we don't know who was the ruler of Decapolis. So if any of you can find out who it was, I'd be only too pleased to receive the details. So, coming back to the chart, as far as Luke chapter 3 is concerned, we have a number of Herods mentioned in the scriptures, two of which were tetrarchs of a region. Now the thing we must appreciate is that Herod the Great died whilst the Lord was still a child. Now we know this because of the gospel records. You'll notice in chapter 2 of Matthew and verse 1. Matthew chapter 2 and verse 1. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem. This was Herod the Great. Now we've got the same reference as we've got on the top of that chart in Luke chapter 1. And that again, in Luke chapter 1, the same record in Luke's Gospel. There was in the days of Herod the king of Judea a certain priest named Zacharias. And this again was Herod the Great. Now if we come back to Matthew's account in chapter 2, we know the circumstances of chapter 2, how that the wise men sought where the king of the Jews was to be born. And obviously we shall look at it in detail when we come to that section in the class. But it was the time when, in verse 19, Herod was dead. Behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, Arise and take the young child and his mother and go into the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life. And he arose and took the young child and his mother and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus did reign in Judea in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go thither, notwithstanding being warned of God in a dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee. And you will notice that on the chart of the Herods, there is no mention of this Archelaus. And it's quite significant because, again, if you'll turn to your map, the territory which Archelaus reigned over was Samaria and Judea. And he only reigned for 2 years, until Rome appointed a governor. So by the time we come to the Lord's ministry, there was no Archelaus. And the only reference we have to Archelaus is that one in Matthew chapter 2. And he only appeared upon world history for 2 years. Because of the awful deeds that he did, a deputation was sent by the Jews to Rome asking for the replacement of this man Archelaus. And as the record in Matthew chapter 2 indicates, he was as vile a man as his father Herod the Great. So because of that, Rome appointed a governor of Judea and Samaria, the most famous of which, of course, was Pontius Pilate at the time of the death of the Lord. But again, we'll give you the details of that a little later on. So that will give us some indication of the Herods of the New Testament. Now, if we can try and either memorize this or sort of keep it handy, we should keep referring back to these Herods, because apart from their obvious influence upon what was going on at the time, they also had quite considerable influence over the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And therefore it was a combination of church and state, the religion as well as the secular authorities, which contrived, obviously, against the Lord Jesus. So, if we can, brothers and sisters, we'll stop at that as far as the path is concerned tonight. Obviously, there will be plenty of time for discussion. And next time, God willing, we want to try and trace through the history of these Herods and the influence that they exerted upon the time as they prepared the way for the coming of the Master. And I would suggest, and I hope it will be, God willing, that in a couple of more classes we would have laid the foundation so that we can then start to bring the characters into play as far as the gospel records are concerned.